wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say.
You are listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands On Community Radio 90.7 FM. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story with the prison system, or you have ideas for the program, or you would like to get involved, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, 2nd floor, Hudson, New York, 12534.
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do, though I'm way overdue. I'd be stuck.
This is the Prison Poetry Workshop. I'm Ren Smith. When Buzz Alexander helped his prison theater workshop put on a show of monologues and skits, he thought the comedy scenes would be a big hit. But he didn't think about how the prison officials would interpret it.
The warden sent a message saying you were bordering on inciting to riot. We thought we'd done nothing wrong.
Today on the Prison Poetry Workshop, we talk to Buzz about the history of his Michigan-based prison arts organization, PCAP. We also hear about one man's publishing house in Detroit that launched a poetry revolution.
Dudley actually went to the prison and workshopped his poems with him.
We tour Michigan past and present on the next Prison Poetry Workshop. This is the Prison Poetry Workshop. I'm Ren Smith.
So we just look at these little buildings and structures. This always reminds me of something I've seen in a movie.
Some of the blocks on Detroit's east side have a motley quality to them. A single-family brick home with neatly cropped lawn and flower boxes will loom right next to a skeleton version of the same house. And those seem to be the lucky blocks. Others loom hauntingly desolate.
But so we saw what? One, two, three standing houses. And I guess that would leave maybe 12 missing.
That's Philip Sample. He's a writer and musician who grew up in the neighborhood and came back to it in 2011 after spending 15 years in prison to find it overrun with blight.
We can see clear to the next block.
A former gang member, Sample now writes poetry and records music. So he's remade himself, and he's thinking Detroit will do the same. And that's likely to happen. All sorts of businesses and people, new and old, are committed to the city and to making its future work. Today, on the Prison Poetry Workshop, we look to Motor City as well as some other Michigan communities and explore how Michigan's incarcerated and formerly incarcerated writers use poetry to explore and engage their time. The time they have, the time they don't have, and the time that's inflicted on them, as well as the time they look forward to. We'll meet up with Philip Sample later in the show. First, we meet the poets of Cooper Street Correctional.
The poems we was that
Cooper Street is in Jackson, a factory town in South Central Michigan. Each week, a group of about 10 Cooper Street inmates gather for a poetry workshop. It's held in a visiting room where the faces of various Disney characters beam down from murals. The murals are there to make the place seem friendlier to kids, give it some cheer. Dressed in faded blue uniforms, the prisoners don't seem to need the boost. They're smiling and laughing from the moment they enter. The workshop's leaders are two women in their mid-20s. They started coming here several years ago as part of some University of Michigan coursework. After spending 15 minutes chatting up and checking in with the workshop participants, Aaron Wiley and Lee Sugar kicked the workshop off by posing a hypothetical. One that'll take an unusual turn.
You just woke up, the first thing that happens is you find out that the world's gonna end at midnight. So, go.
Then suddenly, everyone's pen is moving. The group is engaged in what's called free writing. During this exercise, participants write nonstop on a topic. No self-editing. The result is a kind of stream of conscious explosion, one that, in this case, has one inmate producing an ode to hedonism, another writing an apology to his daughter, and yet another, Lawrence White, turning the end of the world premise on its head.
Never know. So who in the hell got this breaking message reporting live from the future and telling me it's all over? Hang it up. But it's not like they never lied before, been wrong before. Do they know who's handling the red button? Or have woke up after hearing God's voice startled off of a hangover, semi-drug overdose, confused and haunted by their own demons, which they now wish upon the world, worrying about my future? But news flash, it was never real in the first place, and never began, for even when you come and go, life still lives on. So maybe the real problem is you thought you mattered more, thought that realization was news, for there would be no more illusion to have had your emptiness, to help fill your void. So in all actuality, you're dead already.
Lawrence's approach prompts several different reactions.
Like, you're like, no, the world's not ending. Like you're just like turning up.
Not like they ain't lied before, so I'm going with that one. True. They got the wrong story. True.
The discussion is fluid and fun. There's a lot of laughter, tangents, and digression. Lee and Aaron participate, and even though they're technically in charge, don't necessarily come off that way.
I think that we're both very conscious in acknowledging it, but at the same time, both just very laid back in our presence there and really just kind of letting things come as they do and letting conversations happen as they will.
The workshop seems so laid back, so open, it's easy to forget where we are. Later, as the group discusses Allen Ginsberg's Howl, we take Lawrence aside to talk about prison life. During the workshop, Lawrence comes off as a kind of class president, energetic and eager. But he says he's a totally different person when he returns to a dorm-style cell he shares with seven other inmates.
You may know through, you know, my poems, I'm not the most talkative person, you know, and I guess that's the opposite side of my being in my situation so long, because I don't communicate with a lot of people outside of myself, if that makes any sense.
What Lawrence means by his situation is that he's been incarcerated for over 20 years now, ever since he was 17. Doing hard time puts him in a special category of prisoners.
Although we're surrounded by people, this is why you might hear a lot of people say that they be lonely in here, and you're surrounded by 1,700 other guys. How can you be lonely? But that is part of it. You don't relate to everybody.
For Lawrence, who likes to tap out his poem on a typewriter before presenting them to the group, the workshop staves off the isolation that comes with having lived the entirety of his adult life in confinement. But for inmate Glenn Reynolds, it's a second chance, a way of picking up where he left off. The 24-year-old, who's been in prison for 3 years, remembers penning his first poem at 11 and says he got his work into some local publications.
My parents didn't know nothing about me writing, but because, you know, it was like we come from a blue collar city, so art was not really a thing to get into. So when I finally showed my parents some of my writing, they kind of shot it down because they didn't really get it. So it made me stop writing for a long time.
Though it seems cruel, they might have just been trying to protect him. It's hard to make a living as a writer. The sad irony is that prison has given Glenn a chance to pursue his childhood dream. He's obsessed with poetry now.
Like, I keep pieces of paper around to write certain lines down or certain titles down. Like, I'll be asleep at 3 o'clock in the morning and I'll pop up and I'll write down a couple lines and I'll build on it later and stuff like that.
And, he says, this offers more than one benefit.
If you don't keep yourself busy, it leaves you open for getting into trouble in any shape, form, or facet.
If that's the case, you have to wonder if pursuing poetry could have saved Glenn from arriving in prison in the first place.
Another day, maybe even the last, but this has been stated before. We'll see who has the last laugh. The predictions, the rambling, the moaning and bitching. Come on, man, how many times have we heard this? Boy, cry wolf, the sky's falling, blah, 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 so what?
It turns out that imagining the end of the world can be particularly harrowing for prisoners. Why? What if, after you're finally free, the clock suddenly runs out? Jonathan Ford says it's something he thinks about a lot.
This is actually a fear that I have, that I'm going to go home after doing all this time and the world going to end. So that was really real, what I was saying. That was for real. I actually think that's going to happen.
That would be... Yeah. That'd
be Aaron and Lee didn't know the conversation would go this way. They thought this exercise up on the car ride over. But when you think about it, who'd be more anxious about an impending doomsday than prisoners? A cell block is a time machine. Inside, everything slows down, while outside, everything speeds up. When the prison time machine finally whirs to a stop, it's the future. Prisoner Glenn Reynolds says it can be maddening.
I feel the same way sometimes. Like, I'm going to do all this time, and as soon as I step out, it's going to be a big-ass boom for no reason. And then family out there waiting on you, hey, what's up? Boom. Yeah, the world comes to an end. It's like, wait a minute, man. This ain't fair. But I think that's just like a natural. This ain't the first time I've heard this. Like, as far as being locked up, I think that's something that certain guys have a fear of, that everything going to come to an end as soon as you step out.
The conversation is so engrossing that when the two-hour workshop is over and guards come in to round up the prisoners, everyone looks stunned. For a while, something that almost never happens at Cooper Street happened. Time got away. The inmates were in a different world, and so were their facilitators. Aaron again.
We enjoy it so much, and it's so much fun, and everyone's like, why would you do that? Like, why would you spend your time doing this? It's when it comes down to it, it's so much fun, and the space that we have created is so engaging and so wonderful, and something that I don't really necessarily even get with my closest friends. I don't share my poetry with a lot of my closest friends, but I go there and we open up and just have these incredibly like intelligent, engaging, emotional and thoughtful conversations that kind of spark creativity, and it's something that I find just to be really important in my life.
The prisoners not only get intelligent, engaging, emotional conversation from these gatherings, they get a new identity. They're not just the crime they committed or the number printed on their shirts anymore. They're poets. They're Sylvia Plath, Paul Laurence Dunbar, Walt Whitman, Audre Lorde, voices that span the ages. During the workshop, Jonathan Ford, the prisoner who first mentioned worrying about the apocalypse, writes a poem about embodying the poetic experience.
One day I was given the opportunity to picture a poet. This poet composed a poem with no words. He had no nouns, no verbs, adverbs, or any of that absurd nonsense. That nonsense that makes no sense to adepts initiated in the depths of consciousness. I pictured this. Poet, poem, no words. He used a paintbrush as a pen, stroking the canvas of fleeting wind, carrying Picasso cathedrals, with every stroke of his vocals resonating vibrational images through sound waves depicting thy soul's experiences. Picture this, a poem with no words. Astonished, I picture this poet as he composed his verse. He dipped his paintbrush in blood, sweat, and tears and painted his poem of pictures, biblical-like scriptures upon my mind, my unconfined mind, combined with the cosmic shine refined by time. Time spent upon the top of my tree, concentrating my chi until I was able to close my eyes and see. Better yet, just be. Because I am the poet and the poem with no words. I picture me. I am poetry. Who are you?
Coming up on the Prison Poetry Workshop, we'll move back in time and see how the Prison Creative Arts Project, or PCAP, the program that Lee and Aaron operate their workshop through, got off to an extremely rocky start.
The warden sent a message saying you were bordering on inciting to riot. We thought we'd done nothing wrong.
We'll also look at the past and future of publishing prison poetry in Detroit.
But in 1937, I sent a poem, and the editor sent the poem back. And it was not until I put out a book in 1971 that that poem was published.
I'm Ren Smith. Stay with us. This is the Prison Poetry Workshop. I'm Ren Smith. So you just got a glimpse of a poetry workshop run by PCAP, the Prison Creative Arts Project, run out of University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. They also conduct workshops in art and theater in prisons and schools throughout the state. All that began in the 1990s, when an artist-activist couple got involved with some hard-knock communities. One half of that couple is this guy.
I'm Buzz Alexander. I've been in the English department since 1971 at the University of Michigan.
The other half is this woman.
I'm Janie Paul. I'm an artist, and I'm a professor at the School of Art and Design here at the University of Michigan.
They're a charming duo, wild-haired, astute, and in their 60s. Visiting their home, located in a burg just outside of Ann Arbor, the first thing you notice is the walls. They're covered from top to bottom in art. Prison art.
Anyway, and then
just the tip of the iceberg.
All of these drawers. A lot of these drawers, these flat files, are filled with art that has been donated to us by the artists.
Their basement yields the kind of meticulously organized art trove you'd expect to find in the back rooms
we built
of a museum.
Specifically. I used some grant money that I got to build the storage unit.
They need the space. PCAP runs the largest prison art show in the nation, a show that features about 200 artists from nearly 30 Michigan prisons. Janie and Buzz have ended up buying or being given some of that work. The result is a cache of stunning pieces. Janie leafs through several paintings and stops on a realist landscape painted in watercolor.
But this is a beautiful piece. I mean, there's just incredible detail. A house with a porch and pine trees and a meadow in the distance and a road in the front. There are a lot of pieces that have houses and barns and buildings and landscapes that I always think of as being, you know, a restful place to be, which is what people are always seeking.
But while some prison artists might use their art to escape their surroundings, others use it to comment on them. One of the more haunting paintings shows children clinging to a hooded executioner as he reaches for a group of prisoners.
And I think the title is Save My Daddy.
It's disturbing, and it's supposed to be.
They're trying to grab this guy. They're trying to reach out to their fathers, and they can't.
He's got these big hands with black gloves, and he's controlling these cages in which men are locked up, and the children are trying to get to their fathers.
Like much of the art produced in PCAP, the paintings show an immense amount of skill. But navigating past the cliches prison art sometimes falls prey to can be tricky.
We see a lot of, you know, teardrops and roses, and those are things that's fine. But we wanted to let the artists know that they could do more than that.
So several years ago, when PCAP put out its annual call to artists, they put a moratorium on the mundane. They basically said,
we would like for you to actually explore more idiosyncratic work. And what was so interesting was the next year when we went around to select the work, we heard from people that that was really helpful.
If PCAP is a resounding success, it didn't start out that way. After its first ever workshop, a theater workshop, culminated in a performance, officials would accuse it of paving the road toward chaos.
The first performance was called The Show.
Conducted at the Florence Crane Women's Facility in Coldwater, Michigan, The Show was a collection of monologues, dialogues, and scenes. It featured some heavy drama mined from the lives of the workshop participants.
At the end of the play, the audience stood up and applauded us. Just they stood up, rose to their feet, and applauded us. And then when we went out of the prison, we were shaken down very severely.
It was a surprise search, Buzz remembers. Guards patted them down aggressively, went through every stitch of clothing and every bag. At first, he thought it was a random occurrence.
And we thought, well, they're just shaking us down severely, and we didn't think anything of it. The next day, I called the deputy warden, Roger Foltz, and he said, you can't come back. And the warden sent a message saying you were bordering on inciting to riot. We thought we'd done nothing wrong.
Maybe Buzz should have expected that. After all, the show had aired some painful material. But as it turns out, tragic moments weren't the problem. The funny ones were. In several skits, Buzz played the slapsticky prison guard, bumbling through his job. In one scene about subpar prison food, he wielded a rubber chicken. The audience, a group of 80 female prisoners, roared. The guards, not so much.
What happened was that they didn't think playing a correctional officer was comic. And I learned that very quickly.
Luckily, the warden reversed the decision and allowed PCAP's workshops to continue. It was a close call. PCAP has learned to be careful, but not just with the turnkeys. Workshop facilitators are expected to show the prisoners genuine respect, and they have a particular way of making sure that happens.
Because prisoners are very good bullshit detectors. They know.
Philip Sample, the Detroit native we heard from at the beginning of the show, knows what PCAP's workshops look like from the other side. About 10 years into his sentence, he ended up attending one of the group's poetry readings.
The Poet's Corner, that's what they called it. And one of my friends was a member of the Poet's Corner. And he said, man, you know, come to the reading and hear us do some poetry. I say, sure, you know, I'll support you.
Philip says that by then, he was the definition of a cynic, having spent too many days in solitary confinement, too many years with racist guards. So when he encountered outsiders at the poetry reading, he had some questions.
So when I entered this room, I seen inmates and college people, meaning students and staff alike, mixing and mingling in the same environment. Now, mind you, these college people were white people. So, you know, I'm like, oh, what the hell is this? You know, and kind of like, you know, looking at Buzz and the whole thing, like, you know, what is their angle? Is this a ploy to examine the beast?
What quelled his skepticism was watching Buzz read his own raw and honest poetry alongside prisoners. It's a PCAP rule. No sitting back and watching. Whatever workshop participants do, facilitators do. I know it seems like a small thing, but think about it. In prison, the small things matter. Even minor infractions can get a prisoner in trouble and maybe even threaten his or her release date. Sample recalls a moment behind bars when he found himself terrified of a simple accessory.
I had ordered a watch, a wristwatch, you know, through the ordering system, you know. When I got the watch, you know, I was excited. It had the stopwatch, in there, that's like, this is big stuff. You know, not only is it something to do, but it's, you know, it's something to, you know, occupy time. But anyways, I was endeavoring to set the watch. and a beep, you know, I guess what the alarms sounded like, you know, a beep, you know, and it just, and I couldn't stop it. And it's like the longer it went, I started panicking.
On the outside, if a watch malfunctions, it's annoying. In prison, it felt like a crisis. Philip didn't know what the consequences would be. He might be punished.
And I'm panicking, like, man, you know, and it really, and my heart started beating. I started sweating, you know. I tried to muffle it under the pillow, you know. So finally I came out, and the first person I saw, I threw it to him. And I said, like, how do you make it stop? And they caught it and made it stop. So I'm like, why did that watch sound have that time? And I live around chaos and noise all day.
The next day, during a PCAP session with Buzz, Philip picked up a pen and let it all out.
There is a plethora of horrid and horrible, disharmonious cacophony corroding the cracked corridors, alleys, tracks, avs, and cul-de-sacs that my life is. You fear it, cannot hear it.
He used his poetry to look into his misadventure with the watch, to turn it over in his mind. Contextualize it.
The watch needed to be set. I am the type who neglects instructions, moved by the assumption, the gumption to think I can complete said task without assistance or need to ask for aid in getting in sync with you. Pushing buttons, beeps, indigo, numbers flashing, hands turning, dates fluctuating, countdown, seconds, minutes, what the hell is happening in my hand? Suddenly, that beep, constant, relentless, sent this shockwave through my system. Perspiration, heart racing, I couldn't take it. Damn it, panic, almost throwing it over the tier I appeared, clutching chaotic time in my hand, screaming to the top of the rock. How did you make it stop? How did such a minute sound, you ask, produce such a profound response? The nuance of the flute barely audible under the basses, violins, bassoons, like the real motherfucker surrounded by buffoons. I am playing my role, though barely seen, for it's the only role I know what I mean?
The poem illustrates what PCAP offered Philip Sample. It didn't transform him into a new person or anything. He'd done that work long before he encountered Buzz. But it did help him turn a moment of helplessness into art. And art, wrote Tolstoy, is a means of union among men, joining them together in the same feelings, and indispensable for the life and progress toward well-being of individuals and of humanity. This is the Prison Poetry Workshop. I'm Ren Smith. This is the part of the show where we ask you, the listeners, to do a little writing. There's a prisoner Buzz has known for many years named George Hall. George, who's a lifer, might not have much time left.
He's now an old man. He's, I think, 77. He's in a wheelchair. He has low oxygen content. Every winter he gets bronchitis, and they won't let him out of prison. And it's probably because of the original crime, because if they let him out, it would be all over the newspapers.
One of the ways prison time works on a lifer like George is by burying him before he's dead, submerging him in a tomb of disconnectedness, covering him up in numb exile. That's something George explores in a poem he wrote called Stranger with a Rope. Here's Buzz reading it.
Prison is like a pool of deep water. At first, so clear that you can easily see the surface and grasp the reaching hands of family and loved ones holding you, keeping you from sinking. But years pass and grips tire and loosen. One by one, finally letting go until all are gone, and you begin to slowly sink deeper and deeper into the murky depths that have become your world, and the light above slowly fades into pieces of imperfect memory until finally all that remains of hope is an unclear vision of a stranger far above somewhere with a rope and the prayer that she will throw it.
So, listen to the language that George uses to represent his time in prison.
Prison's like a pool of deep water. Years pass, grips tire and loosen. The light above slowly fades into pieces of imperfect memory, and that's his experience. I mean, that's what he's writing about in this poem. I think he wrote it maybe 8 or 9 years ago, and that's been his experience. He doesn't have visitors anymore.
Buzz wants you to write a poem, regardless of where you are, in prison or at home, about how you would deal with being completely alone. How would it feel to be George?
Write about your own experience, because anything can happen. Just think ahead about your experience and about what might happen because you're hospitalized or because you enter in some asylum or something and people don't come to visit you and so on. So you have to project.
Start by putting yourself in isolation and then let your imagination wander, your emotions flow. You can send these poems to us at Prison Poetry Workshop, P.O. Box 448, Wilmington, North Carolina, zip code 28402. That is Prison Poetry Workshop, P.O. Box 448, Wilmington, North Carolina, zip code 28402. Or visit us online at prisonpoetryworkshop.org. Go there and you can hear poems from prisoners read by you, our listeners. Here's a little sample.
Hi, this is Diane Leffer, and I'm reading A Quest for Love by Carl Newton, who is incarcerated at Red Onion State Prison. A Quest for Love. As I patiently walk in the shadows of desire, my heart burns with an insatiable curiosity to experience the entirety of your existence. Your presence alone creates a salacious energy that floats me away from equilibrium and yet at the same time balances my being with a crutch of hope. The boundaries that restrain me are as an unseen prison, guarded only by the morals of respect and the appreciation of your existence. Your scent penetrates the walls even I myself have put up to defend my emotions against such vulnerability. How can this be? Has an irrational emotion overcome what has been put to rest in my heart? Or is it irrational to let slip away the opportunity to once again explore the boundaries of love from an individual incarcerated at Red Onion State Prison?
We play this game in bars and schools. I'm thinking of bars and schools. I'm thinking of representations and mystifications, games of reality negating tangibility, redefining existences to exclude resistances, and behind it is our school, our opportunities, masking incongruities. We dance to justice and forget what justice means.
This is Elizabeth Chestnut reading A Gangster's Prayer by Cedric Dean, who is a federal prisoner. This prayer is for all my gangsters in the hood, those who don't or won't pray but should. God, I know you're mad, mama's sad, the devil's glad because I've been bad. With tears you cry, I need to fry, don't want to die, Satan told a lie. Gun in hand, robbed my fellow man, still I stand wanting to see the promised land. What must I do to be saved? Ain't ready for that grave. Make me brave so I can behave. Tired of being cool, I was only a fool. Take me to school, teach me the golden rule. Show me the way, day by day. No more selling, yay, price too big to pay. Change my heart, I need a new start. We'll work at Walmart just to play my part. Allow me to do good to my neighborhood. I wish I could without being misunderstood. Forgive my sins, I want to be born again. Be my friend so I can be a man amongst men. Amen.
Poems from prisons around the country. Coming up, prison poetry in Detroit, then and now. You're listening to Prison Poetry Workshop. Stick around. This is the Prison Poetry Workshop. I'm Ren Smith. In 1965, poet Dudley Randall founded a Detroit publishing company called Broadside Press. The first piece of writing Broadside published was his own, the iconic civil rights poem, The Ballad of Birmingham.
Brother dear, may I go downtown instead of out to play and march the streets of Birmingham in a freedom march today? No, baby, no, you may not go. For the dogs are fierce and wild, and clubs and hoses, guns and jails, ain't good for a little child.
Written after the Ku Klux Klan bombed a black church in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963, killing four little girls, the poem depicts a conversation between a mother and child. The mother forbids her child from attending a civil rights rally, only to send her to church on the tragic morning of the bombing.
For when she heard the explosion, her eyes grew wet and wild. She raced through the streets of Birmingham, calling for her child. She clawed through bits of glass and brick, then lifted out a shoe. Oh, here's the shoe my baby wore. But baby, where are you?
Dudley's Press would help usher in the Black Arts Movement.
The 1960s was very, very vital, and there was a lot of activity.
Melba Boyd teaches Africana Studies at Wayne State University in Detroit. She wrote a biography of Randall and worked at his press in the 1970s. She says the energies of the civil rights and Black nationalist movements inspired a Black culture swell in Detroit.
There were readings, very important event when Langston Hughes comes to Detroit. That was extremely important. And he was brought here, I believe, for the dedication of the African art collection at the Detroit Institute of Arts.
As a result, there was growing interest in Black poetry, but that poetry wasn't easy to find.
In 1965, there was very little publishing activity.
Although he was already an established writer by then, Randall knew how a dearth of places to publish could hamper a poet, placing him or her in a time warp.
But in 1937, I sent a poem, Hastings Street Girls, to Opportunity, and the editor accepted it. But then Opportunity ceased publishing, and the editor sent the poem back.
That's the late Dudley Randall from a documentary Melba Boyd produced about his life called Black Unicorn.
And it was not until I put out a book in 1971 that that poem was published. That was about 40 years later. And the poems that were published in the 60s had been written maybe in the 40s.
Randall would not only make Broadside a beacon for struggling poets, he'd make it a beacon for imprisoned poets as well. That all started when he published a talented upstart named Etheridge Knight, a.k.a. Prisoner 30562.
After Dudley, you know, had accepted the first poems, that clearly was an indication that he saw him as having talent. And Dudley actually went to the prison in Indiana. I mean, he actually visited him there and he worked with him, workshopped his poems with him.
Decades later, Knight reminisced about those early days.
I met Dudley It was in the mid-60s. I had a bunch of poems, and I wanted to get a book done. And I mean, I really had an audience in the prisons, but I think I wanted to extend my voice, you know, over the walls. And he asked me about it, and he just started Broadside Press, and he wrote to me, and I sent him a bunch of poems. And he came down to the prison and visited me, and we sat in the visiting room and started working on the poems for the book. And I'm sure it was in the mid-60s, 65 or 66.
In publishing, Knight didn't just gain a sense of accomplishment. He found a new and more expansive worldview.
And if it had not been for poetry, I think I probably would still have been in that vicious cycle going into prison and out of prison. I don't know, poetry, like any arts, causes constant self-examination. It causes a kind of awareness of my own self and the world outside of me, too.
Dudley, like Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Gwendolyn Brooks, helped mentor Knight.
I liked him right off. He's a gentleman. You know, it's something that's very unusual in that whole environment. You know, he's very clear, and his talk was gentle and concise. And he was a teacher. I knew he was a teacher. I didn't mind admitting to him that I didn't know as much as I let on like I knew.
And Dudley brought new dimensions to Knight's poetry.
Then he taught me the more formal aspects, more the craft. If anybody who reads my poetry and read Dudley's and Glenn's, I mean, it's clear that they're my major influences. You know, it's almost plagiarism to some points. I mean, I knew they were the best out there. And Robert Bly made this statement once. He says, minor poets imitate, major poets steal outright. I think I picked the best.
Knight died in 1991 after a celebrated career. Here he reads one of his most famous prison pieces, a poem he wrote as he whiled away time in solitary confinement, The Idea of Ancestry.
Taped to the wall of my cell are 47 pictures, 47 black faces. My father, mother, grandmothers, one dead, grandfathers, both dead, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, cousins, first and second, nieces and nephews. They stare across the space at me, sprawling on my bunk. I know their dark eyes, they know mine. I know their style, they know mine. I am all of them, they are all of me. They are farmers, I am a thief. I am me, they are thee. I have at one time or another been in love with my mother, one grandmother, two sisters, two aunts, one went to the asylum, and five cousins. I am now in love with a seven-year-old niece. She sends me letters written in large block print, and her picture is the only one that smiles at me. I have the same name as one grandfather, three cousins, three nephews, and one uncle. The uncle disappeared when he was 15, just took off and caught a freight, they say. He's discussed each year when the family has a reunion. He causes uneasiness in the clan. He is an empty space. My father's mother, who is 93 and who keeps the family Bible with everybody's birth dates and death dates in it, always mentions him. There's no place in her Bible for whereabouts unknown. Each fall, the graves of my grandfathers call me. The brown hills and red gullies of Mississippi send out their electric messages, galvanizing my genes. Last year, like a salmon quitting the cold ocean, leaping and bucking up his birth stream, I hitchhiked my way from L.A. with 16 caps in my pocket and a monkey on my back. And I almost kicked it with the kinfolk. I walked barefooted in my grandmother's backyard. I smelled the old land and the woods. I sipped corn whiskey from fruit jars with the men. I flirted with the women. I had a ball till the caps ran out and my habit came down. That night, I looked at my grandmother and split. My guts were screaming for junk, but I was almost contented. I had almost caught up with me. The next day in Memphis, I cracked a croaker's crib for a fix. This year, there is a gray stone wall damming my stream. And when the falling leaves stir my jeans, I pace my cell, a flop on my bunk, and stare at 47 black faces across the space. I am all of them, they are all of me. I am me, they are thee, and I have no sons to float in the space between.
As it turns out, publishing a prison poet attracts other prison poets. By the time Melville Boyd began working as an editor at Broadside Press, prisoners from around the country were sending in their work. The poems flooded in.
They were coming from everywhere. They were coming from, you know, prisons, and, you know, some of them good, some of them terrible. And the thing about Randall, again, you know, God bless him, because, I mean, he would like, especially these guys in prison, I mean, he would like handwrite them a response, you know what I mean? That's why he was so far behind, you know? It's just like, we sent more books for free to guys in prison.
After a while, Boyd says Randall even put a group of essays together to help prison poets develop their craft more. He asked famous black poets of the day, like Gwendolyn Brooks and Darnell Lee, to contribute.
Because he keeps getting these letters, people asking him for advice on how to write poetry. He says, well, you know what, we need a book to send to these people.
Naomi Long Magid, who started her poetry house, Lotus Press, in 1972, remembers how pervasive broadside poetry books were back then, particularly a series of pocket-sized chat books Randall published.
It did create an interest in poetry. People who had never read poetry before were seen walking around with several books of poetry that Broadside Press had published and writing their own. But a lot of the poets' work was uneven, but it was popular at that time. It was a political necessity.
As a premier publishing house that illuminated the black experience, Broadside emerged a force to be reckoned with, publishing 200 titles in a decade and featuring literary giants like Gwendolyn Brooks, Robert Hayden, Margaret Walker, Audre Lorde, Amiri Baraka, Nikki Giovanni, Sonia Sanchez, and of course, Etheridge Knight. In 1981, the mayor of Detroit would declare former librarian Dudley Randall the first ever poet laureate of the city. Broadside Press is still around today. The oldest African-American publisher of African-American poetry in the United States. It's now a nonprofit. The honor of being Detroit's poet laureate has been passed on to Naomi Long Magid. It's the digital age, so incarcerated and formerly incarcerated poets have all sorts of ways of getting their writing out there. But sometimes, the best medium is the human voice.
Prophet Yeshua helped free the captive souls from their chains. Their prayer said, let's get free, and get free or die trying. Queen Harriet Tubman told me that she could have freed a lot more of our people, but they didn't know that they were slaves.
Peace, my name is Sean Morbey. I live in Detroit, Michigan, and I do a plethora of things that include poetry, drawing, motivational speaking, most recently commercial driving, 18-wheelers, and I actually hold a third-degree black belt in the art of smiling.
Sean attends and MCs open mics around the city and does spoken word poetry.
That was never meant for our salvation, because you can't get free through something that's
I probably started when I was a teenager. It went back and forth between poetry and rap, which is kind of parallels each other, if not the same. But I started to take it serious upon really my first year incarcerated.
Sean is very specific about how long he spent in prison.
6 years and one day.
And very specific about it not being something he's proud of.
When I was 19, I actually ended up going in. They sentenced me to first-degree child abuse. What ended up happening was that I shook my daughter out of anger, but lied about it like a dumb kid. And the judge gave me like the worst sentence possible, which was 3 to 15. So I ended up doing 6 years off of that.
He's matured a lot since then and has become a popular figure around town. Spoken word poetry culture is big in Detroit. No wonder. Poets like Sean have put a lot of effort into mastering it.
to share uplifting poetry means the world to me. I understand the importance and the power of my voice, my throat chakra, and I have to use it for good and not evil.
Here's Sean delivering a poem called Prisoner.
The giver by Nawa must be by God, Jah, Allah, Yahweh and Jehovah for my sins. So why am I to be forever condemned by a much lesser being like you? You who knows very little of my past pain, present agony, or future hell. You who knows very little of my struggling soul, yet it is you who eyes judge me, and it is you who minds forget about me. I am still here. Why can't you see me? Forget hearing my cries. Feel them. Feeling them drowning my aspirations of ever getting out, flooding my lungs of hope inch by inch, day by day with the fluids of despair. I am only getting older. Optimism that was once a close foundating boulder has de-evolved into a flimsy pebble trying to blow away in the wind, and I try my hardest to grab a hold of it. As I try my hardest to ignore the echoes that reverberate within my psyche telling me this, battle for freedom, you will never win. Let me out. I shouldn't be here. Not according to my family. They said they would get me out soon. They said it won't be long. That was 2 years ago.
What Sean does continues a grand tradition.
We'll end today with a poem about Detroit by the current poet laureate of the city. You heard from her earlier, Naomi Long Magid.
My windows and doors are barred against the intrusion of thieves. The neighbors' dogs howl in pain at the screech of sirens. There is nothing you can tell me about the city I do not know. On the front porch, it is cool and quiet after the high-pitched panic passes. The windows across the street gleam in the dark. There is a faint suggestion of moon shadow above the golden streetlight. The grandchildren are asleep upstairs, and we are happy for their presence. The conversation comes around to Grandpa Henry, thrown into the Detroit River by an Indian woman seeking to save him from the sinking ship. Or was he the one who was the African prince employed to oversee the chained slave cargo, preventing their rebellion, and for reward set free? The family will never settle it. Somebody lost the history they had so carefully preserved. Insurance rates are soaring. It is not safe to walk the streets at night. The news reports keep telling us the things they need to know. The case is hopeless, but the front porch is cool and quiet. The neighbors are dark and warm. The grandchildren are upstairs dreaming, and we are happy for their presence.
Detroit's poet laureate, Naomi Long Magid. Prison Poetry Workshop is produced by Andrew Parsons with executive producer Nick Sabrilla. The rest of the Prison Poetry Workshop team are producers Julia Botero, Paul Van Dekar, with special help from Hannah Sheehan and Judith Tenenbaum. Special thanks to Sari Adelson, the staff at Jackson Street Correctional Facility, and Bunchy Yusuf Shakur. You can find more poems, blogs, and even videos at prisonpoetryworkshop.org. You can also send us your prison poetry at Prison Poetry Workshop, P.O. Box 448, Wilmington, North Carolina 28402. That's Prison Poetry Workshop, P.O. Box 448, Wilmington, North Carolina, zip code 28402. Prison Poetry Workshop is a project of Appleshop. Support for the Prison Poetry Workshop in part comes from the National Endowment for the Arts, Creative Capital, Kentucky Arts Council, the Doris Duke Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation. And remember, put pen to paper and start writing. We free singers be.
You have been listening to the Prison Voices Project, a radio storytelling project highlighting the voices of people impacted by the prison system. The Prison Voices Project airs on the second and fourth Thursday of every month from 10 to 11 a.m. on WGXC Hands-On Community Radio, 90.7 FM in Greene and Columbia counties. If you are listening to the program and would like to share your story, or you have ideas for the program, please write to us at 704 Columbia Street, second floor, Hudson, New York, 12534. If you have feedback about what you have just heard, you can email us at feedback@wgxc.org. Thanks for listening.
I wish I knew how it would feel to be free. I wish I could break all the chains holding me. I wish I could say all the things that I should say. Say them loud, say them clear, for the whole round world to hear. I wish I could share all the love that's in my heart. Remove all the bars that keep us apart.